Welcome to the Free to Choose Media Podcast. Today's podcast is titled Human Accomplishment, The Pursuit of Excellence with Charles Murray. Recorded in 2004, Dennis McQuestion, former clinical professor of corporate governance and executive director of the Institute for Excellence in Corporate Governance at the University of Texas at Dallas, and Charles Murray, the W.H. Brady Scholar at the American Enterprise Institute, discuss Mr. Murray's views on government policy, culture, achievement, and human potential, with particular emphasis on his book, Human Accomplishment. We hope you enjoy today's episode, and don't forget to subscribe to the Free to Choose Media Podcast.
Hello, I'm Dennis McQuestion, and welcome to a special edition of the McQuestion Program. I'm here with Charles Murray, and he's a most interesting person, and you probably have heard of him before. But he is the senior fellow at the American Enterprise Institute in Washington, D.C. He's a prolific writer with articles appearing in newspapers such as the New York Times and the Wall Street Journal. Charles has written about American social policy, what it means to be a libertarian, the controversial bell curve, that was 10 years ago, and this newest book, which is Human Accomplishment, The Pursuit of Excellence in the Arts and Sciences, 800 BC to 1950. Charles, welcome to Dallas.
Dennis, I'm delighted to be here.
Well, I've given them some of your credentials, but tell us, who is Charles Murray and why do you write these books?
I write books I want to read. That's the short answer. Let me go back a bit. I started out as a social scientist evaluating government programs on contract to a private nonprofit research company. This was back in the 70s. And after doing that for several years, I saw a theme in the programs I was evaluating, which was that they didn't work. And yet these people who were doing them were trying very hard. And so I finally went out and wrote the book that became Losing Ground. The argument of that being that there are lots of ways in which the efforts to help the poor make matters worse. Okay, so that's how I got started in this business of writing about social policy. And I continued that in a fairly straight line through the bell curve. And at the end of the bell curve, which, as you know, was extremely, extravagantly controversial reaction to that book, in which very few of the reviewers, as far as I could tell, read the book, I wanted to write about something that was exciting and celebratory and fun. And I'd always been interested in greatness, human greatness, and that's why I ended up with this topic.
Well, this book, which is Human Accomplishments, is extremely interesting, and it does, as you say, it celebrates excellence. And gosh knows, in today's world, we need to celebrate excellence. But how did you define what excellence was, number one, and then how did you pick out who were the most excellent over this long period of time?
Well, you know, there's a technique that's been around now for 150 years that's very straightforward, whereby you take, let's say we're talking about Western music. You go and you get the Harvard Biographical Dictionary of Music. You count up everybody who's there. You list everybody who's there. You go get a French History of Music, and you list everybody who's there. Well, there will be a lot of people that are only in one book, and then there will be other people that are in both. You get a third book. You keep up the same process. As you compile these sources, and I'm giving a very non-technical description of what I'm doing, what you end up with are kinds of layers of importance of the people. The ones who everybody must talk about and spend a lot of time on are at the very center of it. Those who most of the books talk about and spend a fair amount of time on are sort of the next layer, and so forth and so on. The point of all this isn't so much to create the lists of the top tens, although those are fun. We can talk about those if you want to. The real purpose of it is to define the population of people and events within which you are trying to figure out why it is that you have some periods in human history and some places where you have these eruptions of great accomplishment.
Well, that's one of the things that I think is always a challenge for us when we're taking either history in college or after college, or we're taking social sciences, is trying to, Bill Moyers used it on this program, the idea of connect the dots, is so to speak. How do we get from this to this? What caused this and this? So give us an idea of some of what you would call your major findings were when you were doing this research.
Okay, let's put them into two piles. One is the standard set of explanations that you have for various phenomena, for wealth, you know, economic growth. That's an obvious candidate for explaining accomplishment. And think of the example of Florence, which a lot of people immediately say you had all these rich merchants. They had lots of discretionary income. They wanted to impress the neighbors. So they said to Raphael, I want one that's bigger than the one that you sold down the street, and you had a huge market for this. Okay, wealth does help. Wealth helps in a variety of ways, such as providing the ability to support universities and the ability to support a class of people that are engaged in this. So wealth plays a role. I'll tell you the most important single. This is so simple that it's the kind of thing that you would say, well, why do social scientists bother to prove it? But it's worth knowing. If you come in a generation that's right after or concurrent with other great figures, the chances are your generation will produce more great figures.
So it's almost, is it mentoring or is it just an expectation? Is it a change in the culture? What is it that enables these things to, once they get started, they apparently continue to go on?
For at least a while.
For at least for a while. And then what causes them to peter out?
Exactly. Well, the answer to your first set of possibilities is yes to all of them, because sometimes there were actual mentoring relationships. Mm-hmm. Sometimes just plain competition. Because if your competition is Raphael and Michelangelo, you had better be good in order to play in that ballpark. And you also get better because you have those models before you. That is so old that, I mean, that phenomenon is so old that you have a Roman historian writing in the first century AD who is reflecting on why it is that in Athens you had within a single generation or two all of these great philosophers who all knew each other, who were all friends, and then it begins to die out. And I think you can think of it as a kind of half-life, so that the creative power of one generation is transmitted in part to the next generation. The models that then are for the third generation, other things equal, you tend to have a petering away.
Let me take you back to Florence, because you mentioned that. You write about it in the book. You spoke yesterday at SMU for the National Center for Policy Analysis and for the other folks at SMU. And one of the things you talked about was Michelangelo. And for that person who may have not ever been to Florence, or maybe even have not even seen some of the David and all the other works he did, one of the most impressive things I saw in Florence was, and the David's impressive, but some of the works of his that were unfinished.
Yes.
Where the figures, I mean, I get a cold chill every time I think about it, where the figures were basically coming out of the marble. You said something yesterday about what he had done to some of his works.
Yes.
Tell us about that.
Michelangelo, in his old age, when he still had his powers, artistic powers, continued to sculpt. Mm-hmm. And he had a number of statues that were nearly completed, mm-hmm. and he destroyed them.
Wow.
And because they did not live up to his standards. Mm-hmm. And of course, we would sit back and say, why did they let him destroy these? Because they would certainly have been good enough for us, but they weren't good enough for him. Which goes to another characteristic of these giants that I don't think is sufficiently appreciated. You know, when we think of fame, it's easy to think of people who've been lucky. And they were at the right place in the right time, and so they make millions of dollars and so forth, but they aren't really that much better than other people. And that does happen with fame. With excellence that endures over the century, one of the common themes throughout is they work like crazy. And by work like crazy, I don't mean they work 50 hours a week. It's a monomaniacal kind of obsession with their work, which cuts across the sciences and the arts. And in Michelangelo, you had that big time.
Did you find, and I don't know if it was, I forget which piano player it was, it doesn't matter, I suppose, but the story goes, and I'm sure that's probably true or maybe not just a story, but that someone came up to the piano player after he had finished, he had just played so well, and the admirer said, I would give my life to play the piano the way you do, and he said, I have.
Yes.
Is that what you found?
It's that kind of obsessiveness. And you know, when you try to talk about the differences between men and women in these areas, that's one of the things that I think is probably relevant. My wife and I talk about this a lot. She's my editor, among other things, and so anything I wrote about women had to go through her.
Well, you gave her nice credit in the book, too, I'll tell you.
And we were talking together about this monomaniacal aspect of it. And motherhood is really, I am confident, even though the science is still in the process of developing, it's just such a huge distraction in this regard. My wife is a writer, for example, and I'm using this as an anecdote, but I think the generalization is appropriate. It's not that hard for me to block out a big chunk of time, and for that chunk of time, those kids don't exist. Exactly. I love them, but I'm working. And for her, it is effectively impossible to say, for the next 3 hours, I am not going to think about whatever issues are currently involved with the kids. And I think that somewhere in the mix of explanations for differences, that must be in there.
Well, when all the stuff that you wrote about social policy is an example, there's always the wage differential between men and women, and that obviously explains
similar kinds of dynamics are going into
that. But when you look back over, let's just say 2,800 years, you wrote about 4,002 individuals. I love that, 4,002. And only, what, 88 of them were women.
Yeah.
And some of it had to do with motherhood, I'm sure, but others of it had to do with what?
Well, start with the simple stuff, which is that until very recently, women simply were not permitted into the sciences, for example. They couldn't go to university. They literally could not do that. And so when you have a big, obvious explanation like that, you put that one up first. But I don't think that gives nearly enough credit to the interesting ways in which women are different from men. And consider, for example, literature versus music. In literature, you have had great women writers since Sappho. And it's not just the West. You had Murasaki Shikibu, who wrote The Tale of Genji, one of the great sort of proto-novels. You've had great women writers throughout all the civilizations from the top beginning. Music, there is basically, I know I shouldn't say this maybe quite so bluntly, there have been no first-rate women composers, and not even really many second- or third-rate women
Why
composers.
Why is that? Do you have any idea?
Well, it seems to me that it's no longer enough to say that the exclusion of women from a field explains that kind of difference. That kind of difference, I think, is probably going to differential aspects of the human brain. And I lead off the discussion of women, I should say, by saying, now, I'm going to tell you alternative theories which have been proposed and some data for them, but we don't need to scream at each other because 20 years from now we're going to know the answer. I think if you were to ask me to make a bet, given the available data, one of the consistent differences between men and women in cognitive functioning is processing of three-dimensional objects. And it's very easy to think of why males would have a superiority in that, because if you're out throwing rocks at rabbits, it really helps to have good processing abilities in three dimensions. And that also would play into a highly abstract art form such as music. Now, having said that, I offer that as an interesting hypothesis that we don't know yet.
Well, you have offered up a lot of interesting hypotheses, and I want to take you back now to the bell curve. First, tell us about you and your co-author, who unfortunately died just as the book was published almost 10 years ago. Tell us why you wrote The Bell Curve and what its major premises were, and then why it was so controversial.
Back in the mid-80s, I had been pretty much in the mainstream of my attitude toward IQ tests. I assumed that they were culturally biased. I assumed that they didn't really measure intelligence as much as they measured acquired characteristics. Sort of you run through the litany of the things that the New York Times says are true about intelligence tests, and that's what I believed. And then I was exposed to some of the technical literature, which said quite different things. And I started to look more deeply into the technical literature. And I came to think that in trying to understand the reason why some social phenomena in this country play out the way they do, that to ignore the role of IQ is like closing your eyes to a very big, obvious cause that simply has to be put in the mix. And so I knew Dick Hernstein through other means. I knew he wrote on these issues. He had written an article in the Atlantic Monthly, which made me think that maybe he was in the process of writing this book that I was beginning to think about. I called him up, asked him if he was writing this book, because I didn't want to try to compete with him. And his answer was, and I'm quoting verbatim, I think, "No, but let's do one together." And my answer to that was, "That's really interesting. Let me think about it a minute." I called him back later that day and said, "Yes, that was the sum total of our negotiation. on this." We worked in that for 4 years. It was the most wonderful collaboration, other than my marriage, that I've ever had. It was just terrific.
I am one of those people who did read the book, by the way. And so you said to me, a lot of people bought the book and a lot of people read the book. But this is one of the things that, and it doesn't matter to some extent where you are on the political scale. You can talk Al Franken and Ann Coulter today, who are yapping at each other back over the airwaves and on all the talk shows. I don't know if half the people who believe with one or the other have read the other person's book,
yes,
frankly.
Right.
I can tell you Franken has read Coulter's. I've read both of them. But I read your book, On the Bell Curve. And I found it, a lot of things I find that I don't know much about, I find counterintuitive. In this case, I didn't find this counterintuitive. It's one of the things it said to me is, the smarter you are, the more likely you are to do better financially. Isn't that one of the premises?
One of the,
That sounds pretty
Dennis,
right to me.
Dennis, let me take advantage of your offer to let the viewers know what the bell curve is about. It is about the relationship of IQ to a whole bunch of important social and economic outcomes. And part of them is just as simple as the one you just said. People with higher IQs, on average, we're always talking about means, on average tend to have higher incomes. Not rocket science.
Not rocket science, I didn't think.
But there are other things as well that do get more controversial. And here is where I want to emphasize something. I think if we went out and asked 100 people at random what the bell curve was about, those of them who had heard the book would say, "Oh, isn't that the book that tried to prove that blacks were genetically inferior to whites?"
Mm-hmm.
That is not only not a contention of the, not an important contention of the book, it's not a contention of the book. I want to put that on the table. We do talk about differences in black and white test scores and their implications, but the core of the book has nothing to do with that. And in fact, we explicitly take a look at samples exclusively of whites, just to make that point. If you take a sample of whites and talk about likelihood that a woman will have a baby out of wedlock, likelihood that a woman will be in poverty, likelihood that a man will be unemployed, and go through the others of the important social outcomes, we say, look, even after taking social and economic background into account, even after taking education into account, et cetera, you have a strong independent role for IQ. Mm-hmm. The reason that's important is because if you're going to try to solve certain social problems, your solutions have to be one that are coordinate with the causes. And if you say you're going to cure poverty by making everybody go to college, you aren't talking about a realistic approach to the problem.
Well, one of the things that I've always liked about your books, and one of the things I've not liked about your books, is the same thing. They're well researched. and the reason I say that is because, you know, if you're reading a novel for pleasure, as an example, I mean, you're going through it and you're getting this and the other, but reading your books, and they're very well read, so they're easy to read, but there's those end notes all the time that are there, and you want to go, "Oh my gosh, let me see about that." And it just aggravates me, then it turns against, okay, who was it who said that? And the thing about the bell curve that just got me when I read what people said about it is that they said, "Well, he just makes these assertions." There are no assertions in the book except for, and I think it was John Mears out at SMU yesterday, he said, "One of the things I want to tell you that is that in this particular book on human accomplishment, Charles Murray has all these caveats." It said, "I'm not trying to say this, I'm not trying to say that, blah, blah, blah." You said in the bell curve 500 times, if you said it once, "Look, don't jump to different conclusions from this stuff. We're just talking about here's what," and you go out through all these statistical things and all that drive some people, including my producer, crazy when you're talking about statistics. But the bell curve itself, tell us what the bell curve is. I mean, everybody knows that something goes up and like this, but tell us what that means and how it plays into what you were doing.
The bell curve looks like a bell. And it corresponds to what we all know from everyday life, which is that some people are really, really industrious, let's say, and some people are really, really lazy. Most people are somewhere in between. Most people are somewhere average in terms of their intelligence. A few people are really dumb and a few people are really smart. And so you have people in the center. The reason why this is relevant to the topics we talked about in the bell curve is that those people out on the edges drive a lot of the outcomes. The people in the middle, you know, the people in the middle of the bell curve are smart enough to do just about anything they want to with their life. Intelligence is not a problem in terms of living their lives. It's people who are got the short end of the stick, who find it very difficult to function in today's world in many ways. And it's also the people, and this is a message I wish had gotten through, the people at the top of the bell curve have got to be very careful about how they see the world. I'll give you an example, Dennis. I talked to an assistant principal of a very wealthy Darien, Connecticut, very wealthy New York suburb. Public school. The mean IQ in the public school in Darien, Connecticut is, as I recall, 118, when the mean is 100. So in other words, if you go to Darien High School, the people that you consider dumb are actually
pretty smart.
Pretty smart. Yes. The problem is that the people in Darien, when they graduate, they go to a relatively small number of universities.
Ivy League
where they
schools,
where they hang
Stanford,
out with the same kind
places.
Of people.
Sure.
There was a fellow named Mickey Kouse, who's a journalist, who once observed that he doubted if he had a close friend who scored less than 600 in his SAT verbals. Mm-hmm. And he was right. And a lot of people haven't. You have decisions being made about what we're going to do with the world by people who have had very limited experience of what the full range
of
human
is.
Beings are like. And that's what we call the cognitive elite. And one of the things that irritates me the most, of the many things that irritate me a lot about people when they talk about the bell curve, but one of the things that irritates me the most is that Dick Hernstein and I are too in love with intelligence and so forth. We think we have a very double-edged sword here, and we are not fans of the cognitive elite and a lot of the ways they function.
Well, you're exactly right. In fact, I would recommend to that viewer to get not only your new book, but The Bell Curve, and read The Bell Curve. Because one of the things that really got to me, I mean, I don't think you even got to some of the race issues or all that until chapter 22 or something.
It was late in the book.
Late in the book. But what got me most was this almost, I'm not going to say it was a warning, but it was almost a warning from the two of you. And it's, again, it's been a while since I've read it, but it almost seems as if you were saying to that reader, the cognitive elite are great, they're wonderful, they're necessary, but if we're not careful, the American society is going to separate into the cognitive elite who go to the same schools, they hold the government jobs, get out of government, they go to the big industry jobs, et cetera, they have academia, they populate the academia, and then sort of everybody else. And there's this disconnect where you can't communicate with each other, and ultimately
yep.
the country's not well off for it. Is that true or not?
Yes, that's a very accurate characterization of what we were worried about, and I don't think it's a prediction about the future. I think that in a lot of communities it already exists. So that, and actually I guess I'd ask viewers to look at their own situations and their own children and ask themselves, to what extent do my children have genuine diversity in their schools? Genuine diversity meaning both socioeconomic diversity, but and also are they running up against people all along the bell curve in IQ? And I bet the odds are that a lot of them have to say, no, that's not true. And I guess the response to that is there's only so much you can do as an individual, but at least with your own kids, you can try to make sure that the environments they experience as they grow up and in college and in their first jobs are ones which throw them into the real world.
Mm-hmm. Well, let me take you back now to Losing Ground, which mm-hmm. is one of the
1984,
first major, 1984, yeah. So it's been 20 years ago. In Losing Ground, now, for that viewer who doesn't know, a lot of times people who write books like you do, they say, well, that's some far right-wing something or another. You, as I recall, didn't you join the Peace Corps out of college or something?
I was in the Peace Corps.
Didn't you go to Thailand for a while?
Yeah, I was there several years.
Right, so, and you actually worked in doing government research, isn't that true?
Yeah, and I was and not only that, Dennis, I remember, I did not identify myself as either on the right, let alone libertarian, until
late
1970s, I was beginning to realize that's the direction I was mm-hmm. going. But I have not always been a right-wing ideologue.
So I guess the thing that surprised me and impressed me was when you wrote that book on Losing Ground, you wrote it, again, well-researched, is that, you know, let's look at what the facts are and here's what happened. So tell us what the premise was of losing ground and what you found in your research.
This is one of the books where I did have a thesis going in, which I developed over the 1970s as I've been evaluating these programs. And the thesis is this, that social programs and government interventions in the lives of the poor, in effect, set the rules of the game. They send out all sorts of signals about this is how you're supposed to behave, through incentives and disincentives and the rest of it. And it was my view then, and continues to be, that the social reforms of the 1960s sent out all sorts of signals and incentives and reset the rules of the game that made life extremely difficult for poor people, and particularly young poor people. I don't think it was sufficiently emphasized that a great deal of the social problems we encounter happen because of adolescent decisions. Whether it's a young woman who has a baby without a husband committed to take care of it, whether it's the guy who says, oh, I'm not going to get a job right now, that's chump change, I'm going to lead a more exciting life for a few years. You can make decisions, and people do make decisions in their adolescence, which can derail them permanently in life. If you're in a family that's affluent, you also can make decisions that derail you. Your family is there to pick you up, usually, and jerk you back onto another path. The kinds of mistakes you make if you come from an inner-city neighborhood, poor neighborhood, are not so easy to correct.
Well, here's the thing. I'm going to get back to these cognitive elites of the bell curve for a second, because it seems to me that many of these cognitive elites run the government. Mm-hmm. They ran the government for a long time, the last 50 years, I would say, for sure. And again, if they're not connected with reality, if they don't have the research that you do, it seems to me, whether they're on the Democratic side or Republican side, doesn't matter. They're still in a situation where they are saying, we know what's good for this group, and here is the policy, the government policy, whether it's a welfare program, a food stamp issue, affirmative action, et cetera, that's good for them. And so we put those things in place because we think that's the right public policy. Mm-hmm. Is that basically the way it works, or how does it work?
I think, first point is that I think we can assume the good intentions of everybody. And so if you have people who have, let's follow up on the example I just used. A person could say, look, you just got done saying that a middle-class family will rescue their kids. Well, what we want is the government to be rescuing their in the same way. Well, the difference is this, that when the middle-class kid goes off the rails and the parent provides a support, it's usually with a kick in the pants as well as lifting them up again.
Tough love.
There is usually a very strong sense of, boy, did you screw up, and you've got to get your life in order. In the successful cases, I think that's a very strong component. Governments are real bad at doing that. Governments can provide benefits. They can provide rules under which benefits are dispensed. They're very difficult at taking two kids and saying, what this one really needs is tender, loving care. What this one does need is a kick in the pants. And it's the problem was not liberals. The problem was not bleeding hearts. The problem was trying to use a mechanism of the bureaucracy to produce certain human ends which bureaucracies are inherently unable to provide.
My friend Steve Pavich, you may know Steve Pavich, he's an economist. He just retired from Texas A&M, explained it to me a few years ago in words that I could understand, and I'm going to explain them to you as I recall it. When he was talking about bureaucracy, and it works whether it's bureaucracy in a corporate environment or bureaucracy in government, we just seem to think of bureaucracy and government as the same. But what he said to me is, and let me see if it has any connection to what you're talking about, he said that it's not that these people mean to do badly, it's just that they don't have the appropriate incentives. If they do something that doesn't work out well, typically they don't pay the price for it. In many cases, they may get more money thrown at the program, but even if it doesn't do well. On the other hand, if they do something that happens to work pretty well, they don't necessarily reap the rewards from it. So the incentives are just not there as they would be in a private solution. Is there anything to that as it plays out into
People try to change that so that they will take a welfare bureaucracy and they'll try to change the incentives facing caseworkers so that they get rewarded if their clients get off the welfare rolls and back to work. And there are certain kinds of the reinventing government mechanisms that maybe are better than nothing. But I don't think that gets to the heart of it. I think that when people make decisions about their lives, they're not done with a calculator. Let's go back to the young woman who gets pregnant. Charles Murray, are you telling me that you think that girls decide to get pregnant so that they can get a welfare check? No. What I do think is that the reason why girls don't get pregnant boils down to my daddy would kill me kind of thing. So there's this very strong sense of I can't do this or I shouldn't do this, which has been, you know, something that they have learned from the time that they've been little tiny girls, all right? Well, the way that happens is if the environment surrounding the world in which they grow up validates that point of view and validates it in a couple of ways, and this is where things get tough. It validates it first in the lessons that are taught. That's not tough. I mean, that's just, you know, the teaching the right moral lessons, but also validating it so that if you look at the girl who did get pregnant, it was a disaster for her. And that's where it gets tough, that you cannot have a system in which you are successfully deterring large numbers of girls from doing something disastrous without there being a genuine price that is paid for the mistake. And that's the kind of thing that in the 20th century became very hard for people to accept.
Is it the situation there's no shame anymore? Is that the issue?
Yeah, there's no shame, and also there's, look, if you are in a situation where if you get pregnant without a husband, and I'm focusing on this issue because I think this is at the heart of a lot of the underclass problem, children growing up without fathers. If you're in that situation and you say, well, look, if that's the case, either you can get the guy to marry you, or you can put the child up for adoption, or else you are going to have to take care of this child by yourself with no economic support, the child in such a case will often end up okay because either the father will marry her or at least be forced to pay support, mm-hmm. or the child will be put into a good home through adoption.
Correct.
The young woman herself does suffer a terrible psychological price, if mm-hmm. nothing else. And it's been very hard for people who talk about social policy to talk about the inevitability and the reality of that kind of pain.
Well, and today, I have a friend who teaches, and you've seen a lot of people who teach, and that today, if you're teaching an alternative school, and some of the kids are 11, 12, 13 years old and are pregnant in that school, some of those young girls are just saying, I made the decision. I wanted to get pregnant because I wanted, you know, as silly
something
as
to love.
someone to love me and
yeah.
something to love.
Well, you know, I have never had a difficulty understanding why it is that a girl who's gone through puberty would find babies cute. That's pretty hardwired. I have never had any trouble understanding why young males who have gone through puberty would like to sleep with women. We're talking about very natural things. And so then you go back to a question of why is it that throughout human history, in throughout civilizations, you have had both a male and a female responsible for children coming into the community in the overwhelming majority of cases. And the reason that that has been done is because if you don't run communities that way, they start to fall apart. And it's these kinds of basic dynamics that govern communities that I think we aren't coming to grips with.
Well, and you write a lot about the culture. You've had several articles in the Wall Street Journal in the last year, two or three, about culture. I want to take you into the book that you wrote about being a libertarian. First of all, I'd like for you to explain to that viewer what a libertarian is. Let's start there.
Real quickly, a libertarian is what used to be known as a classical liberal. I mean, and we libertarians say, basically, we have the political philosophy of George Washington and Thomas Jefferson. We believe the government has very limited functions. But those should be done very, very well. And that means the rule of law. So you have laws against fraud and use of force, including all the crimes, and you enforce those to a fare thee well. But otherwise, government exists to enable people to go about their lives free of the fear of force and fraud from other people, and in Jefferson's words, to pursue their own pursuits of industry and reward and fulfillment. So if the libertarians had their way, the government that exists now would be stripped down to a fraction of its current size.
But here's what people who don't believe like you would say, is that, you know, how can you possibly believe something like that? I mean, we have old people who depend on Social Security. We have young people who depend on AFDC. We have sick people who depend on all sorts of ADA programs. We have minority groups who depend on affirmative action. I mean, how can it sounds like a really heartless position to take to say that the government ought to just protect human rights.
If you're saying, what would we do to get from point A to point B? How would we get back to such a thing? It would cause enormous dislocations, and that's a very complicated subject. But having said that, take the aged, for example. It seems to me that what libertarians need to argue much more richly than they have is to point out that as soon as societies have acquired wealth, that in the absence of government programs to transfer funds, mechanisms developed by people as a matter of a natural social interactions deal with these problems extremely effectively. But here, Dennis, is a very important point. Don't give me a world, on the one hand, in which no children are hungry and no aged people are lonely, versus my world, which is a libertarian world, in which some people will be lonely and some children will suffer. It occurs in both worlds. And I would say the amount of suffering, let's take the case of children these days, is in large part a product of the interventions by the government. That if you had the libertarian world I prefer, you would have vastly higher proportions of children growing up in homes with a mother and father who love them.
Now, when you say libertarian, are you talking about little L or big L as in the Libertarian Party?
Small L. Okay. You know, one of the difficulties with libertarianism has been that there has been a variety of wings. I am part of that wing which is a big fan of Edmund Burke as well as of Adam Smith. And I believe in a strong role for traditions, a strong role for non-rational values that people have. I'm much more sympathetic to spiritual issues, I think, than a great many libertarians are. So I'm small L. But so are a lot of other libertarians.
Of course, yeah. I didn't think you were talking about the Libertarian Party, which has never been a factor in anything. We did a program a few years ago called, I think it was called Left, Right, and in the Middle or something like that. We had sitting right here where you're sitting, Leonard Peikoff, who you know. We had a liberal friend of ours from California, whose name is Phil Wexler, and we had Phyllis Schlafly, who joined us via satellite. So we had, we had the objectivist, we had the conservative, we had the liberal, and obviously you know where Leonard Peikoff would be coming from, and pretty much where Phyllis Schlafly was coming from. But our liberal friend Phil Wexler, really a nice guy, very smart guy, called himself a free market liberal, I think is what he called himself. And what he said was, he said, I believe in all the free enterprise stuff. He's a business person himself, so he believes in all that. He said, but he gives his examples of people who have real troubles. And he said, I just think that we as a government ought to come in and help these people. And I mentioned this to Milton Friedman, it was probably 5 or 6 years ago when he was here for NCPA, the National Center for Policy Analysis, 15th anniversary. And what he said is, he said, well, fine, but if it were just limited to people who actually had real problems as opposed to trying to subsidize everybody who's over a certain age for Medicare, Medicaid, Social Security, it might be 1 or 2% of the people. Now we're trying to, it seems to him at least, we're trying to subsidize everybody through taxing everybody. Is that the difference?
Well, I would agree with Milton, and just take it a step further. Because I find it interesting to go back and look at the philanthropic systems that developed at the end of the 19th century in Britain. And people said, but Britain, that's Dickens, you know. I mean, that's a terrible cesspool of... Well, I'm sorry. In fact, you had the greatest social dislocation in history, just about, with the urbanization going on there. You had all sorts of reasons for all sorts of things to be getting worse and worse and worse. They continue to get better. Crime went down in London in the last half of the 19th century. But more than that, you had some very sophisticated, extensive philanthropic systems develop, including self-help organizations whereby laborers would join cooperatives to provide themselves with medical care. And I say to people, look, you take the amount of resources devoted to those at the end of the 19th century, as a percentage of gross national product. You extrapolate those resources to today's gross national product, you'd have effectively the same amount of money in many regards that we're spending on social problems, but would have been generated through private systems. And the reason I'm for that is because a private system of philanthropy can do what I said earlier. It can give a kick in the pants to one person and a pat in the back to the other.
Well, there's no doubt about that. I mean, Tocqueville wrote about it when he came here in the 1830s about how Americans are philanthropic. And we've done a lot of programs on philanthropy. One of the foundations that supports us is the Hatton Sumner's Foundation, and then the Meadows Foundation here in Dallas. There's even a program in philanthropy at the University of Texas at Austin that Curtis Meadows started. And the differences between philanthropy in America and a lot of other societies, we are unique in that area. And yet, as you said, at the turn of the 20th century, when the 20th century started, and I'm trying to think of his name down at the university, Marvin Olasky.
Sure.
His book that he wrote on that, it just shows so much the difference between what private philanthropy did, where you gave somebody a meal, but you also required them to chop some wood, versus today where it becomes an entitlement to this group and a tax against that group.
I guess as we're talking this way, and I'm thinking of people in the audience who don't agree with me politically, and naturally I've talked to such people over the years, and I have a feeling I know what they're thinking. I don't think either one of us is saying that we have an alternative which is perfect. I know what I'm saying is it is disgraceful that a country as rich as we are should have an underclass that the size we have. And further, and this is where I would like to engage the left along with the right and say, look, it wasn't working out this way until a few decades ago. The trend lines were going in the right direction, whether you're talking about poverty or whether you're talking about other kinds of social ills. They turned around. And it's important to understand why it is we have a larger underclass now than we had 30, 40 years ago at a time when national wealth has been increasing so phenomenally, and expenditures.
Yeah, I agree with you, and that's a very difficult thing. And it's almost as if policymakers, again, on either side of the aisle, it's almost as if they have this great definition of insanity. Insanity is continuing to do the same things you've always done and hoping for different results.
Yeah, yeah.
And yet, if you look at someone like yourself or other thinkers who have a different way of approaching it, I don't find people just jumping up and down trying to put different public policies in line.
Oh, well, and here's where I get cynical. One of the most convenient things about the current system is that, first, the people who are receiving are not yelling to have things cut. That's perfectly understandable. But also it's very comfortable for those of us who are paying, because we can grouse about, well, our taxes are too high and so forth. But the fact is our taxes are high not because of those programs. They're a small part of the bucket of the government expenditures. And it's very convenient because we've sort of given at the office, as it were. We paid our taxes so that if tomorrow all of these social structure programs and the bureaucracies were dismantled, then the question becomes for people like you and people like me, so now what are you going to do? Mm-hmm. And the thing is that what you're going to have to do is going to be harder, whether it's giving your money to private philanthropies that you think about or whether it's contributing your own time and effort. It's harder than signing that tax check.
Well, I think that's a very good way of putting it. Let me, in the 10 minutes or so that we have left, turn your attention to how you try to address an audience or a one-on-one interview or that person watching this program in terms of trying to get them to, first of all, understand the big picture issues that you write about and that you think about. And then secondly, what can they do themselves to make a positive difference in some of these issues that we're discussing?
Now, the first one, how do I address an audience? I always have, I'm thinking now of my writing, but I think it carries over into something like today's discussion. I always have a person in my head that I'm writing for. And I guess this person could be described as skeptical but open to argument. And one of the things that you then do, and thinking back over our conversation today, I can hear myself having done this, is you try to anticipate what they're saying to themselves, the objections that they are coming up with, and you try to provide answers to those. And you're trying to engage in a dialogue with this other person who is not necessarily agreeing with you at all, and trying to let them feel that you're not banging on them trying to change their mind, but you're trying to engage them. I sort of think that's the way everybody ought to write. I get very tired of, I will say frankly, both the Al Frankens and the Ann Coulters. In that regard.
Yeah.
As for what people can do, I guess, and I don't want to sound pie in the sky about this, the kinds of issues we've been talking about, I think, for a lot of the people watching this program, lend themselves to self-examination. When we talked about the cognitive elites, I'd ask the people who are watching, are you behaving that way? To what extent do you have blinders on because of the nature of the groups that you always hang out with? In terms of social policy, the question I would ask, and now I'm talking to the viewer who is saying, why is this man railing on about single women having babies? Is he some sort of, you know, moralist or something? And I'm saying, well, if you have daughters, how do you feel about them and them having children, not for moralistic reasons, but concerned about your daughter's welfare and the welfare of the child? And then I ask the question, if the way you think about your own daughter is not the way you think about the daughters of poor people, what does that say to you? So I guess that I think with the elites in this country, and elites I'm using in a broad term, I think we have a lot of looking in the mirror to do, because I think a lot of the things that we want in social policy for those people, the poor people, are not the things we want for our own families and children. And that's an important thing to recognize.
I want to bring you full circle back to this book on human accomplishment. And it was not always the elites who accomplished something, who mm-hmm. made this list of 4,002 people. But you did talk about four factors that were typically in place when more of this human excellence happened. Tell us what those four factors were.
Okay, and I will put this in the form of a telegram, because I know we're getting toward the end. And, and the reader, I'm talking about 100 pages of text here. There are the four. First is purpose. Cultures vary in the sense in which a child grows up thinking, I must fulfill my talents within me no matter what. More often, life on this earth, in many cultures, is not the center of your existence. And certainly fulfilling your own desires is not the center of it. It's being part of the family and the community. That's one continuum in which cultures vary. And accomplishment is fostered when people do have a sense, I was put on earth to do this. Mm-hmm. Autonomy is my second factor, and that refers to the sense that you are able to do something on your own, that you as an individual can affect things. And here, one of the themes in the book, and I say this as a practicing agnostic, is the Christian theology is extraordinarily powerful as a statement to people of their autonomy as human beings, able to do things with God's help. The third factor is structural, organizing structures, where I talk about the way that accomplishment is a lot easier if you have a rich, fresh, new organizing structure. When linear perspective was invented, or maybe reinvented from the ancient Greeks in the Renaissance, just think of what that was in a structure to be filled up with wonderful painting. Linear perspective and the use of oils just gave a whole new...
Well, you talk a lot about that in your book. You talk about Brunelleschi mm-hmm. and Florence as an example, and for that
right.
person who's had the opportunity, as we have, to see that and see it sort of come about, and you talk about the complexity there, where a lot of things were going on,
mm-hmm.
And the organizing structure being simple versus robust.
That's right. And another comparison is the sonnet versus the novel. So that you can do exquisite sonnets and you can do exquisite novels, but the organizing structure of the novel is much richer and provides for much more variety. The final of the factors is what I call transcendental goods. And this is the one that I find myself most interesting. In the classic Western tradition, you've got truth, beauty, and the good that are the transcendental goods, that they exist outside our personal experience. They are ideals against which we measure our work. And it is my contention that those are actually raw materials for enduring accomplishment. And a real quick example may make a complex point. Consider Macbeth. It's not a pretty play. blood all over the floor, people dying, nasty people. What makes that different from just simply the quasi-pornographic violence that we have today? There is an underlying moral vision that Shakespeare brings to this, which makes it a tragedy, which understands the human condition that he's drawing upon, whereby the violence clarifies that moral vision. And I think that is true whether it's the visual arts or music or literature, that great work draws upon coherent notions of these transcendental goods that some cultures at some period have and other cultures at other periods don't. At which point I look at the culture of the 20th century and I say one of its problems, and please understand, Dennis, and viewers understand, I'm really simplifying when I say this. One of the problems of the 20th century, I think, has been that art in its various forms has rejected the relevance of transcendental values as raw materials.
One of the classic arguments that we get, though, is that art imitates what reality is, or is it the art that leads the way to depravity? I mean, what's that dynamic? Do you know?
Well, it's clearly true that artists grow up in the milieu that they're in, and if you grew up in the 20th century, you didn't really have the option of saying, I think I will adopt a transcendental sense of beauty to as an asset in my art. You simply grew up in at a time and a place where that was not in the air. That doesn't mean it can't come back in the air again, and I guess that I don't want to leave these comments thinking that I think we're going to hell in a handbasket and there's no hope. On the contrary, I think the last couple of decades, we're coming out of some of that.
Well, you almost, in your speech that you made yesterday, almost used the term of adolescence. Give me more
yes.
on that.
But it's the Murray theory of the last two centuries is that we went into an adolescence. And I mean that metaphor pretty precisely. We had the Enlightenment, where reason suddenly was to overthrow tradition and religion. We had Darwinism, we had Freudianism, then we had Einstein. You can just think of each of these as a hammer blow with these brand new ways of looking at the world. And like adolescents, we decided that we knew better than our parents. And all of this stuff that Aristotle and those people have been saying was irrelevant. And like adolescents, I think it is starting to pass. And I think that there are signs that people are saying you don't have to reject Darwinism and Freudianism and Einsteinianism in order to say that it's still important to draw from wonderful and valuable and rich older traditions that we have neglected, and that we can think about the complex issues of meaning and life, incorporating both.
We have another university here in town called the University of Dallas. It happens to be in Irving. And a few years ago, I overheard a professor who was there talking to someone else, and they were talking about various types of education. They're a liberal arts college. And one of them said, well, you know, how do you teach at the University of Dallas? And the professor said, well, we teach from books. And he said, what kind of books? He said, very old books. And I think that kind of goes with sort of understanding that past, doesn't it?
Yes, certainly does. I remember when I had to explain Aristotle's concept of happiness in a book I wrote several years ago In Pursuit was the title. And I really, when I started out, was not all that impressed with the Nicomachean Ethics. It sounded kind of stilted and archaic to me. By the time I had gotten done trying to translate Aristotle's words into modern language, I was saying to myself, this guy is really smart. This is really subtle, nuanced, and most of all, right in terms of his understanding of human beings. That kind of reawareness of the richness of what our legacy is, I think is really important.
Well, you were able to see, looking at 800 BC up until 1950, the rise and the fall of several incredible civilizations. Mm-hmm. And I guess it would be fair to say that just as in America, the power in the world, so to speak, today, probably at the height of those civilizations, the elites or everybody else always felt they were invincible and would go on forever.
Yes, although here is where I come away from this feeling a little shiver in the back of my neck, because Rome, I had never realized until I did this book the extent to which Rome did very little in the arts and sciences. I mean, yes, they had Virgil and Horace. I'm not saying they didn't have anybody. They had very, very little. And so today, when I say we may have a problem in our culture is what we're producing, certainly in the arts, and people say to me, oh, people have always felt that what they were doing wasn't as good as before, I say back, sometimes they were right. Mm-hmm. And in the case of Rome, we know with hindsight that it was powerful economically and politically, and it was a desert in many ways culturally. And I think we at least ought to be aware of similar kinds of problems that may have developed in the 20th century.
Well, I certainly think you're right about that. And unfortunately, the Roper's done a lot of studies lately, and they actually studied college students at the 55 top colleges. They asked them questions. One of the questions was on geography, and they asked them to look at the map of the world. And it turns out that only 50% of them could find Central America on a map of the world. Oh, only 43% could find the UK on a map of Europe, and 14% of them couldn't find the United States on the map of the world. I thought that was a problem. So we have these issues of not understanding sort of the big picture. I'd like you to close, because we just have a minute left, with a story that you told about religiosity. I think you mentioned that word a minute ago or something like that. And talk about, just very briefly, the people who carved some of the incredible things at the top of, let's say, Notre Dame or some other cathedral.
This is something which I heard many years ago and has always resonated since. It appears that a lot of the gargoyles that were carved for the cathedrals were hidden behind cornices, and they were high on the walls. And so the people who carved them knew that when they took down that scaffolding and went down, nobody would ever see them again. And yet they carved them just as painstakingly as the others. And it was said of them that they carved for the eye of God. And to me, that is a metaphor for the story of human accomplishment.
Charles Murray, I appreciate your writing that book and all the other stuff that you've done and all the human accomplishment that you have done for this country of ours and the world of ours. I appreciate you being here. And product coming out of Newton, Iowa, what can I say? Thank you very much for joining us. We appreciate your joining us too, because as always, we've been talking about things that matter with people who care.
Want more episodes like this? Don't forget to subscribe and get updates each week for the Free to Choose Media Podcast.